Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun, two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello, and welcome back to the International Schools Podcast. This week, I'm delighted to be talking to Ben, my colleague from the UK, who deals with the UK for apps, amongst other things. So, Ben, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Great. Well, today we're going to have a quick chat about design thinking. It's something you're really interested in, and it's something I need to learn more about. So I think it'd be great to have a really kind of high-level discussion about what is design thinking like, from starting from someone that knows nothing about it, which is basically me. I mean, I know a bit because we've been involved in it, but let's say I knew nothing.
I think it's kind of a funny thing, design thinking, in that people don't know the term a lot of the time. So when I'll introduce it and ask the room, like, has anyone heard of design thinking? Then, you know, the majority haven't. It's kind of a simple enough system. It's a logical enough system for approaching problems that people have been using for a long time, because it originated in the design industry.
Yeah, so let's start off with, where did it come from?
The process, I think there's a bit of discussion about whether it came from Stanford Design School or whether it came from IBM or whether it came from IDEO. I think the term design thinking seemed to originate from the Stanford Design School and IDEO. But I think it's a process that companies like IBM, even back in the 50s, were using. And the essence of it is really being user-centric in how you design. So looking at the user and not jumping to solutions too early. So it was mainly around people were doing product design, just gave a name to the process they found themselves using all the time. So focus on the user. So you start off with an empathetic look at the users you're designing for. The greatest example, I think, there's a company called Smart Design, and one of the people from Smart Design was sitting at home watching his mother try and peel carrots with a peeler, and she had the beginnings of arthritis, so was really struggling with it. And he said, I'm going to design a new peeler for my mum. But that's the essence of it, just watching people go about their daily work and designing things that fit for them, not what you think they want, but what they actually need.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same. I mean, I've been involved in some software development. This is a common thing in software where you sort of, you know, you lose track of what problem are you solving? What does someone actually want? And you start thinking, I'm going to build all these cool features and hope everyone wants them.
Exactly that. So that's the thing. While design thinking might be a new terminology for a lot of people, I think it's a system that makes perfect sense when you look at it. Like, start by empathizing with the user. It's pretty much like, oh, well, yeah, why wouldn't you? And then define your problem before you start coming up with solutions. Again, well, yeah, that makes sense.
So are there some high level, like four or five or whatever, like high level subcategories on this process? And my other question is it one of these processes that are kind of based on like continual iteration and improvement, which has kind of become the default project management in a lot of areas now, as opposed to the old standard of a project's got a beginning, a middle, and an end?
Yeah, so the first thing is there are a few different places. So like Future Design School based out of Toronto have a slightly different version. IDEO and the Stanford Design School will show you a slightly different version. And Google internally have their own sort of way of talking about design thinking too, because it's used in Amazon, it's used in Facebook, it's used at Google, as well as being used in schools. So the first bit is focus on the user. So you start with empathy and you undertake process of really empathizing and understanding the user. And there's some techniques that we can go into in future episodes for what that empathy might look like. Once you kind of really delve deep into the user experience, then you narrow back in and try and define what the key problems are that you need to solve. And then once you've got an understanding of the problem you're trying to solve, you then jump into the brainstorming, the ideation process. And the key with that is having lots and lots and lots of ideas. It doesn't have to be the best idea, just have lots. Then when you narrow it in on a few ideas you think are interesting, ideas that maybe haven't been done before, you then take those into prototype, and a rapid prototyping process then to go on and test them quickly. And that prototyping is really the bit that I think is really interesting. There are lots of processes, lots of projects that I'm sure many people have been involved in where you go away and you spend ages tweaking and refining something before you then launch it. And the design thinking process has been really successful in shortening that. So you don't put loads of time, money, and resources into making something that ultimately...
Yeah, in software terms, you call this an MVP, a minimal viable product. Like, you get something basic done very quickly.
Exactly that.
Isn't the problem, though, with focusing on the user that the users don't always know what they want? And it may be... Like, I'm thinking of an example. If you'd, like... Well, it's not my example, but, like, if you'd... Like, the turn of a, you know, sort of Victorian era, if you'd have asked people what they want for transport, they would have said a faster horse, you know? They wouldn't have... Yeah. People don't know what they want, and sometimes you can just give them something amazing and people want it, you know, which they haven't, they don't know. Does design thinking account for that?
Last week, I was involved in the Innovator Academy, the Google for Education Innovation Academy. The one in London. And as a coach, you're taking your team of six through the design thinking process. And to a reasonable extent, when people come in, they say you apply with a challenge or a problem, and then you go through this process to find out a bit more about your problem, do interviews with users. And a lot of the time, people can say, the solution is a website or an app. That seems to be quite often the case. Yeah. So I think there's where you kind of jump into thinking the solution to everything is an app. And the design thinking process is really good at kind of shaking that around and making you look at a different way of looking at it. But as for the users, you interview them, you spend time following them around, but it's kind of less what they say and more what they do that you're looking at.
Yes.
So if we think about the context of schools are busy places, everyone's on the go all the time. Getting the opportunity to maybe shadow a colleague, shadow a student, you're not asking them what they're doing, but if you watch them in their day, you might suddenly see it from their perspective where you didn't before.
Yeah, that's like a really key point, isn't it? Like, just seeing what someone does as opposed to asking them what they do. Because if you ask them, they'll say something very different. Like, you know, if you ask people what do they look at, you know, on Facebook, they'll say, oh, you know, I like reading about some of my friends are doing in politics. But what they really want is like controversial nonsense and cat videos and, you know, stuff they can get annoyed about. But that's not what they'll say they look for, you know.
But take us, right? You want to know what I've been up to day to day.
Yeah, exactly.
And like what I tell you I've been up to might be very different to if you came and stood in the background here and watched
exactly,
me.
Exactly, exactly.
I promise it's amazing high-level stuff
all the time. I'm sure. so you mentioned about schools. Like, what are the origins, as far as you know, of design thinking in schools? How long has this been happening? And then we can get onto what kinds of things, projects have happened in schools.
Ooh, I mean, I can only talk about my
experience. Because I kind of probably heard about it. Like, I'd say... 6-7 years ago, maybe I started hearing about it, maybe more, maybe 8. I mean, that's not saying that's when it happened, but that's when I started hearing about it in schools.
I think I saw a couple of talks at events where people were talking about it, which led me to read a few books about it. And through reading around it, I kind of realized it suggested some solutions to the problems I was having with working in the organization I was in, where I get frustrated that, you know, when you just see something launched and you feel like it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
But you had no idea how they came to that. There's obviously, like, it's not that people go out of their way to come up with a bad idea. But I think the best example I've got is I was frustrated that in order to get a promotion in some of the schools I've worked in, particularly to senior leadership, your application process would be to do a presentation to the other senior leaders about what you were going to do in your role. So if you make me vice principal, I will do this, this, and this. Then if you get the job, you feel absolutely obliged to then deliver on what you presented on. Yeah. So I said I was going to do these three things. So hell for leather, I'm going to get them done. So you have people sort of feeling like their job depends on them delivering the idea they had.
And like politicians who then just ignore everything they promised before they got the job.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where you get that example from at the moment.
Apart from all politicians in the world.
So exactly that. And then you just watch them get frustratedly, like, trying to push their idea through. And obviously, you get to points when you realize your idea is a load of it's not going to work.
Yeah.
But you aren't in a culture where you can let go of that pivot and just start over. And the design thinking process is really focused on have lots of ideas, and the really, really awful ones, you can learn from those, or be ready to do a prototype and test and realize that you were completely barking up the wrong tree, and go back and you realize I just didn't do enough user focused work and empathy work. Can you go back to the beginning? So kind of like that culture of, like, fail first.
It's good to have this framework in mind, because what happens in reality, I think, is that you got more than two types of people, but to generalize, like, you have people who do what you say, they doggedly stick to their first idea. And honestly, like, I don't always think that's a bad thing, because sometimes it's good to finish it and see if it works, if it doesn't, as long as you can iterate quickly. But then you have another group of people who take the design thinking too far, and they're always changing their mind, you know, they get shiny object syndrome. Oh, by the way, we should do this. Oh, this isn't working, we'll do this, you know. You can take it too far, and then nothing ever gets done, you know. I'm probably more on the first doggedly get things done, see if it works, you know, because that's the only real test. But I know what you mean. If you've got this design thinking framework in your mind, then you're kind of taking a middle ground from the beginning. But I think you can't take it too far and not close, because the biggest problem people have with projects is just not closing them off and not finishing them. You know, it's a real, not just in schools, but just in life. You know, you know how many home DIY projects people start and never finish, you know?
That's probably a really key point that we haven't touched on yet, is design thinking is a culture. It's not just something you can do in your own silo. So
yeah,
like, oh, Ben's head of maths, he's a design thinker, and so-and-so head of science is a different, you know, works completely differently.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be a successful design thinker that way. It's not really going to help out, because it's a culture you try to embed across the whole organization.
Sorry, Karen. Yeah.
Oh, just going to, so there are a number of international schools engaging in a longer process of embedding design thinking in the way they work.
Yeah, I know, and we've mentioned before, but John, I know John Mixon in Luxembourg was doing some design thinking stuff for sure.
Yeah, so Luxembourg, I think Brussels, I want to say, and a few other international schools, yeah, in the same way, are sort of using it in a whole sort of school-wide context. But you'll also see it in individual classrooms.
Yeah.
So as a framework for students to investigate problem-based learning, so giving them that framework. And a teacher we've worked with a lot, Sarah Woods, will use it in her design classroom.
Right.
So find a problem, understand the users, and then come up with ideas, prototypes, and test it out with those set of users. And they'll do that within a semester as an iteration for their design project within that design class, as well as schools using it to redesign their whole curriculum and like their community engagement, all of those type of things.
I mean, I guess taking a design thinking approach to design thinking, wouldn't the best way for a school to do it would be to do a small project, like a pilot project, try something out, and then before they kind of, because, you know, we talked about this before, but people at schools get fatigue of different systems and different processes and things, and if something's, unless they see something's definitely working and definitely is going to work and has worked before, they're reluctant, you know, to jump on it, you know. So do you think like a pilot kind of project is the best way to start down this route?
I'd always love to say that going at it as a whole, if you at least start off with a small project, you need to have representatives from across the organization. Rather than just doing it within one department. So, but what it might be is that after doing a wider kind of empathy piece, you realize that you want to do a focus on like the canteen and healthy eating, or you want to do a focus on one particular part. Like, for example, you could even end up deciding that the entrance to the school is is really dire and horrible, and that's what you discover, and you just kind of make that first step into the school a more enjoyable experience. You know, right. There are various different ways of coming into it.
What other things have you seen schools do? Like, what sort of concrete projects have you seen that people use design thinking? You mentioned in the classroom.
Some interesting ones I've seen are like the canteen experience is one where I've seen a school completely redesign their lunchtime canteen experience. So they took a step back and looked at the process, the foods, how they interacted, how the students interacted, how the teachers interacted at lunch, and redesigned that whole process. I think that was the one where students serve each other rather than just going and picking it up separately. Teachers actually eat with the students, and they just kind of changed the culture of how they interacted at lunch, rather than you go get your food, you just eat by yourself. The teachers disappear off to have a bit of quiet time. Yeah. And that was one of the ways I've seen it. There's a bit of terminology coming up here. Design thinking is a large cultural, organizational way of approaching innovation.
Right.
But people may also have heard of a design sprint.
Yeah, and I will tell us, what's a design sprint?
Design thinking is a big undertaking. A design sprint is something that came out of Google, really, the terminology. So a guy called Jake Knapp was working on the Gmail team at Google. And actually, if you want to hear the proper story, there's a book called Sprint by Jake Knapp, which will tell you all about it.
Yeah.
But they'd had this idea that you could do a video call, and they'd been faffing around with this idea for a long time. And then Jake just decided, right, let's block out a week, turn our phones off, put an out of office on the calendar, and let's get this done. They did some empathy work on the first day to understand what the problem was and define where they were going. They did ideas on the second day and into the third. Then they prototyped on the fourth day and tested it out with users on the fifth day.
I can give you a concrete example right now with me, like the App Summit's website, which is moving it to WordPress as a platform, which is taking forever. So like I blocked off all yesterday, half the day before, and early today. And actually I got so much done. I, in terms of buying the theme, found a contractor to work with on some of the customization. I figured out the hosting of WP Engine. Like I worked on the whole spec document. Like I did so much just because I blocked off like the whole of yesterday and plus some extra, you know, like that was all I was doing and I had to get it done. And it 100% works for me, you know. The difficult thing is just blocking that time off.
And that's it. So a design sprint is used by, I've done some sprints with schools, but I've seen it more in the kind of private sector world where you have the CEO, the head of technology, the head of HR, and you'll gather together like about 6, 7, 8 people. And do that. I mean, there is a 4-day version now, you know, like 6-day abs, 5-day abs. But a sprint is something you can do a little bit more quickly. It isn't, you're not going to come out of a sprint with a design thinking culture in the organization, but it is a way of addressing a key problem and quickly coming out with a better understanding and a prototype you can put in front of people.
There's something in the startup world, I think they call it Focus 55 or something, where they have a weekend and they just work on building a product like in a really quickly.
The problem with sprints for schools is the concept for a school that you want about 7 or 8 of their key staff from across the organization to be pretty much uncontactable for definitely 2 days, yeah, possibly 3 or 4, is just like, whoa, that's madness.
Are you familiar with Scrum project management? Because I know they have like sprints. They have a daily stand-up meeting and then daily sprints, I think it is, in terms of to do work on projects.
Yeah, I mean, it's common within Google to do that now, and a number of other organizations do it. The way that we did it with one international school was they, during their in-service days, at the end of the academic year, they put aside. So we did 1 day sort of early in the summer term, and then we did 3 days in a row in their in-service time,
right,
where we did a sprint focused on a number of different things. So I said, ideally, you do it with 7 or 8 people. So we did it with a whole staff, and they jumped off into project teams and looked at completely new ideas. So one was like taking the whole of grade 8, and what if they don't set foot in school that year and their whole learning experience is carried out around the world, wherever they want to go.
Right.
And they prototyped that. So they prototyped it with like kind of like a promotional video for the students that came in as the testers, and got them to almost like a post-it note exercise, build their year's experience. And what they found was that the teachers were extremely excited about it as a prospect. But what they did in the prototype and test, they found out the students were more nervous. So the students had questions like, but who's grading my work? And like they had practical concerns. So it wasn't that they shelved it, but they realized that there was that their learning from that was, it's not a no-go. The students need more, we need to build towards a point where the students would feel comfortable that kind of learning experience.
Definitely. Look, I think that's pretty much a good place to kind of finish. I wanted this to be a quick introduction to design thinking and the sort of basics. We'll get into it some more. We'll get into some more detail in the future episodes. So just to recap, I guess, the stages, it goes through kind of empathy and then definition, and they're kind of looking at your graphic there to focus on the user. And then after definition, you get into brainstorm, prototype, and test. They're kind of the 5 stages, I guess, of design thinking, if you're gonna break it down by stages.
Yeah, and you'll see a few different diagrams if you search it. The reality is it's a big, messy bundle of going back and forth.
Yeah.
A few books if people want to get started. There's a great book called Design Thinking for the Greater Good by Jeanette Litka, which is a good place to get started for schools, public sector kind of charity-based projects. And then I've also started working through the Design Thinking Playbook. So that's Michael Lurick, Patrick Link, and Larry Leifer. So a couple of options to get started with.
And of course, get in touch if you need help. We run design thinking workshops as well, of course, so we'd love to talk. And you know, if you want advice, contact us. We'll often say, workshop or some training is not right for you right now, but we can definitely just give you tips. We do that all the time, and we like doing that.
Well, there's some design sprint style sort of 45-minute, 1.5-hour sessions that I've done for people to kind of dip their toe in, just kind of gives them an idea of how, even like if you just feel like your 1-hour end of day meetings go nowhere, I've got some great little tips on how you can make that a more engaging and useful process too.
Fantastic. Ben, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time today.
Absolute pleasure. Catch you soon.